What more do you want from me?
I don't want peace. I want problems, always.
The hunt is on, and you're the prey.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to another edition of Office Hours with your brother, Professor Carl Tone Jones. I am Professor Carl Tone Jones, and I truly appreciate everybody pulling up. I know it's been a little while since you've heard my voice, at least a live version of it, but you're getting it right now. And I knows you miss me. Like the old song saying, I know you want to leave me, but I refuse to let you go. So I'm back. So you can go ahead and get your beverage. Snuggle up next to your loved one. And, keep, you know, put your feet up. Kick your shoes off. Put your feet on the coffee table. Yeah, I said it, goddammit. And you know it.
Me personally, I wouldn't take this level of disrespect.
Yeah, we're rocking out live with y'all, man, and looking forward to just, you know, getting back into the groove of things. It's been a very long and tenuous period in my life, and exhausting. Some of the mental hurdles and things I've had to deal with, you know, on a day-to-day that I don't divulge, and you know, it's not really anybody's, not fair for me to burden anybody with those types of things, but it does burden me. So I'm just, you know, just letting you know that I didn't forget about y'all, and I know some of y'all in particular look forward to this being your pick-me-up for the week. This being sort of the show that gives you something to think about. We keep it, you know, straight, no chaser. We rip it from the heart, and we say the things most are afraid to say, especially here on Office Hours with your brother, your dear brother, Professor Carl Tone Jones. I am a community servant, an advocate, and, you know, a man with a purpose to helping men form and shape better versions of themselves, offering the tutelage to the young men that are coming up behind us, and bringing them forthright so that they can be the vanguard, the leaders, the next stage in evolution for our community. So one of the things that I would really, before we get into this, you know, I really, really want to talk about, you know, something that happened that it just recently transpired, and I really, really, really hate to be the bearer of this type of news because, you know, this brother was sort of like a shining light in the dark chasms of what we call the community, the black community. So let me just start off with this, y'all. Let me start off with this.
Today, there are heartbreaking new details in the accidental drowning death of Malcolm Jamal Warner.
In the morning, Mr. Warner had surf lessons with his family.
I spoke with one of the lifeguards in Costa Rica. He reveals Malcolm's 8-year-old daughter was also rescued from the water.
There was a gentleman, I believe, from Nicaragua that was there with a practice surfboard and was able to get the daughter out. He put her on the surfboard and was able to kind of push her close enough to shore. She was okay. They found Mr. Warner pretty quickly. They could see a shadow on the bottom of the seafloor, pulled him up and put him on top of the surfboard and gave the 5 respirations. That was not successful. There were 2 other doctors that were there. They worked on Mr. Warner for at least 30 minutes, and then he was unfortunately pronounced dead.
And the other man who was in critical condition, how is he doing?
My understanding is that he's recovered and he's fine.
How does something like this happen so quickly?
Once you go under, it can happen within seconds. And as soon as you ingest water or you panic, that's when you sink.
That day, the remote public beach had only a few dozen surfers, so volunteer lifeguards patrolled other locations.
Would it have been a different outcome if there had been a lifeguard on duty that day?
100%. Having the personnel is what's critical. This would have been avoided.
If you could send a message to his wife right now, what would you say to her?
I'm extremely sorry for her loss, our loss. I wish we would have been there.
Today, Malcolm's body was released to his family to be flown back to the U.S. The Cosby Show alum was intensely private, never sharing his wife or daughter's names. But as we saw in our many interviews over the years, they were always on his mind.
We have a 3-nager. She just turned 3, so she's an official 3-nager. We are a nanny, we are a playmate, we are everything.
So you're awesome. Tired. You're tired.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
A production.
I hear you're like, she goes, Mommy!
our daughter runs the house.
Yeah, and it was tragic to, you know, to hear that story. So just let me get a little bit into who Malcolm Jamal Warner was. All right, and still is, because, you know, his legacy and his memory will always live on, right? So Malcolm Jamal Warner, born 1970, was an American actor, a black American actor, producer, musician, best known for his role as Theo Huxtable, also Theo Huxtable on the popular sitcom The Cosby Show. He began acting at a young age, making his television debut in 1982 on Matt Houston Beyond, The Cosby Show, and he starred in the sitcom Malcolm and Eddie and Read Between the Lines, and had numerous guest roles on various television series. He also directed several episodes of The Cosby Show, and I do recall that being under the tutelage of the legendary Bill Cosby, and just being brought in. So he was born in Jersey City, New Jersey, August 18th, 1970, and he was partially named after Malcolm X, the brilliant Malcolm X, and jazz pianist Ahmad Jamal. So he began acting at age 9, attended professional children's school in New York City, made his first television appearance, as we said before, on Matt Houston. He was cast as Theodore Theo Huxtable on The Cosby Show in 1984, for which he gained most of his acclaim. Other ventures. He directed public health videos, including one on HIV/AIDS, released an autobiography titled Theo and Me, Growing Up Okay. Alright. He has a passion for music, played the bass, won a Grammy Award for Best Traditional R&B Performance. So the brother was very talented. Unfortunately, he met his demise on July 20th, 2025, at the age of 54, in the country of Costa Rica. Apparently, he died swimming with his daughter, his 8-year-old daughter. His daughter was rescued by amateur surfers. Well, surfers with, you know, amateur surfboards. And his death was formally ruled an accidental drowning. And we will all miss our dear brother, Malcolm Jamal Warner, who was not only those things that were described. He was a husband. He was a father. He was a man amongst men. He, you know, was a strong advocate for the black community. He used his voice, used his influence, used his platform to spread awareness and also generate activism around social injustice causes. So we will dearly miss our brother. It's always a painful thing when one of us goes, and then one, at such a young, tender age of 54, he has so much life to live. So we give heartfelt thoughts, prayers, wishes, and condolences to his family, his wife and his daughter, all his other surviving members of his family, in addition to all the many and various people that he's come in contact with over the years. You never heard a bad story. You never heard a bad incident or got a bad report about Malcolm Jamal Warner. He was a class act, and we're going to miss him. So rest well, my brother. You've accomplished more in your 54 years on this planet than many will do in 54 lifetimes. So to you, brother, we say salute and rest well. And now, as we transition into the next stage of the show, this, you know, there's also some other things rumblings going on in the news. Many of you know that over the last few months, former President Barack Obama's wife, Michelle Obama, and her brother Craig Robinson have gone on to create quite a stir with their podcast. Many topics were covered, including many of her regrets in terms of being the wife of a president and a man with political ambitions. A lot of what we can could be considered misandrist talking points, right? But recently, I guess amid all the criticisms and all the skepticism concerning whether or not they were still together, whether they were living apart, and so forth, she recently had aired a show, did a recording with her husband, President Barack Obama. And my God, some of the outtakes, bro, you could not make this shit up in terms of some of the things that were discussed during this time period. So I guess they wanted to quell the rumors as to whether or not they were separating. As many of you know, right after the 2024 November elections, you kind of saw Michelle Obama fall off the face of the earth in regards to what many would consider wifely duties, especially that as a former first lady, not attending the funeral of one Jimmy Carter, and also not being present during the inauguration of Donald J. Trump in 2025, January 2025. And with, you know, many picked up, it was a very humiliating display to see Barack Obama being the only surviving president whose wife was also alive, who did not was not by his side during the inauguration or the funeral. So it's uncustomary for that to happen, because that's the culture. That's their culture. When I say their culture, I'm talking about the political elites. Right? I'm not talking about how I would personally deal with the situation or whatever. I don't think they would want me within 20, you know, within 10 miles of the White House. Considering, you know, how radical my thought processes have been concerning the political structure of this country and its influence on the world and the impact on the world. But nevertheless, there were some very interesting things to come up from this conversation. One thing went particular, went viral. So I'm going to let you all hear this particular, you know, clip by former President Obama. And then we're going to react to it, but also go deeper, take a deeper dive into the discussion. So,
I had a gay professor in college at a time when openly gay folks still weren't out of line, who became one of my favorite professors and was a great guy and would call me out when I started saying stuff that was ignorant.
Mm-hmm.
You need that.
Mm-hmm.
To show empathy and kindness. And by the way, you need that person in your friend group so that if you then have a boy who's gay or non-binary or what have you, they have somebody that they can go, okay, I'm not alone in this. I had a...
Obama is...
Okay. All right. Okay, that's enough of that. So, apparently, President Obama believes that, you know, we, but you know, that and I heard more than just that clip. I heard a good chunk of that interview. Let me tell you something. When, and I don't want to come out all guns blazing. Right, I want to have a serious dialogue about what transpired, because, you know, yeah, some people and a lot of people don't really understand the nature of the people and in terms of how they operate. So if this was just me saying this, then it would be expected that people would just say, yeah, you know, Prof is out of his mind. What is he talking about? You know, he must have misspoke, or he missed. It would have been a whole lot. You could have took it several different directions. But this is a politically elite couple. They have been on the mountaintop. They've risen to the highest status in all of the world. Forget the queen and kings of England and all that other shit. The president of the United States is deemed, I'm not saying it is, but is deemed as the most powerful office in the world. Bar none. It's deemed, so, and the first lady is elevated to a status beyond that of royalty. Think about Jackie Kennedy. Jackie Kennedy then went on to become Jackie Onassis, which actually she was a queen. But nobody thinks about Jackie Onassis. They think about Jacqueline Kennedy, the wife of, you know, assassinated President John F. Kennedy. That was her highest status. Never gained the notoriety of royalty that could surpass, and it wasn't able to surpass the popularity and the prestige of being the first lady, specifically a very public first lady. So to think that these people are not experienced in talking, to think that they don't know exactly what they're saying, the angles they're taking, how it's going to be perceived, the language that they actually use, the words that they actually use, to think is not calculated is a great miscalculation by the rest of us. So when he says that young boys need someone in their lives that can teach them empathy, I can kind of wrap my mind around that. We all should have empathy as human beings. Not just the boys, all of us should have empathy. Just because it's just part of humanity. And human beings should be, at their core, caring for other human beings. I'm not saying it happens, but I'm saying it should be a core value. But when it goes along, I mean, okay, let's go a little further. When he says that we need someone that can hold us accountable for our actions, I wholeheartedly buy into that. Accountability is one of the linchpins of integrity. And many of you know how much I stand on business when it comes to the notion of having integrity. Right? So, in regards to that, if you hear me here, take a pause. It's because I'm being attacked by my, you know, fresh out of the box kitten who has not seen me all day and is missing me. So just give me a heads up. But back to the whole concept of integrity and being accountable. That's a necessary degree. It's one of the things that's missing, right, in society today. Everybody wants to play the blame game. Everybody wants to be the leader until the leader has to be accountable for all the losses that have been taking place in society. Then it's not my fault. So then you get into, well, he's one of my best professors. He was a gay professor. That's kind of where you lose me. I don't pretend to know everybody's sexuality, their sexual preferences, what they identify as when I meet them. many when you engage with them. Unless it's explicitly stated or bluntly obvious, it's really hard to tell these days who's who. And I personally am at a point in my life where I only worry about things I can control. And I can't control, nor do I want to control, how people see themselves. That is another part of learned humanity. However, in making that declaration, to immediately jump to the fact that you may have a son who is gay, and but all boys need this in their lives, is when you stepped over the line, former President Barack Obama. And I say you stepped over the line because you are very calculated with your words. In another part of the interview, you said that one dad was not enough. One man is not enough. Is not enough. Men not enough to raise their children. And then you were corrected by your wife. And then you both, she said, and you said, dads, plural. These are strong implications of possibly pushing an agenda. And let's be clear about something. For the 8 years that President Barack Obama was in the White House, he made very few declarative statements concerning issues and items in the black community. Other than saying Trayvon Martin could have been his son. However, never thought to send the Justice Department into Sanford, Florida to arrest George Zimmerman and prosecute him for committing a hate crime by killing Trayvon Martin. You openly identified yourself as the first LGBTQ president. Stated that Black America, you were not a president of Black America, you were president of all America. You couldn't do things specifically for Black people. See, we remember when Kamala Harris said that, but people like to conveniently forget when Barack Obama said that. We know your history, know your upbringing. We know you weren't raised by a Black man, a Black father. You, in fact, were raised by your white grandfather. And I'm bringing all of these points up. Single white mother and your white grandparents, maternal grandparents. To illustrate what we're witnessing right now. You see, the Obamas are very much influential in many black households in America. See, once they left the White House, slowly but surely, both Obamas came around to identifying with their black roots, black culture. They started moving. Even during the last attempt at shaming black men into voting for one Kamala Harris, Barack Obama tried to appeal to black men by saying, "I have an issue with the brothers choosing not to come home, and I believe it's because they have a hatred for women or dislike for women." So all of these things are speaking to specifically black people. So when you talk in this regard, and the majority of the guests on Michelle Obama's show for black women. We know who your target audience is, and we know you may not be of us, but we know who you're projecting to when you talk. And we, and the question is, why is it? Why was it even necessary to mention a person's sexual preference or the sexual identity when you just wanted to, if it was strictly about raising young men in a way, in a manner in which they were held accountable, and it speaks to them becoming empathetic to the needs of others. And see, this is why we need protocol amongst black men. And this is why I call, because we do things, we see things, we witness things, and we have still not gotten the intestinal fortitude. I've seen a lot of brothers step up. I've even seen some sisters step up and say, this is not what you want to produce, to promote, if you're talking about creating masculinity within black men. In fact, they were critiquing the black manosphere and calling it toxic because issues like this conversation have become more relevant now. So, and I've been working on this concept for over a year now. I really, really wanted to get the ball rolling on it. But like I said before, I had some things come up. And, you know, I kind of feel like Tupac. And you know how Tupac was in, he was in jail. And when he got out of jail, he made albums back to back to back to back to back. It's like, you know, you feel like you're running out of time, or you're trying to make up for lost time. So I find myself in the midst of a bunch of projects that I wanted to engage in. One, you know, being a person down ground zero for the explosion that took place in the Nicetown section of Philadelphia, in North Philadelphia. And seeing the needs of those people. And I understand there was a press conference recently, so I need to follow up on that to see what can be done to continue to provide aid and access to those people. I got some people who I've already talked to. You know, just it's just really just finding the way to organize. And I'm talking about me specifically, around all the other various things that I'm trying to get done to make up for the time that I lost. The restoration of the Joe Frazier gym, but not to turn into a gym, but actually, you know, create a museum that represents Philadelphia fighters, featuring one of the greatest fighters of all time from Philadelphia, you know, one Joe Frazier, Smoking Joe Frazier, right? Had the honor of meeting the man on several occasions, sitting in his office, talking to him, had on his Stetson hat, talking to his son and being invited to train fighters in his gym. You know, it was an honor to me just to have a conversation with the legend. So I think there's something that needs to be thought about. And this is what we talk about. We just talked about the recently late great Malcolm Jamal Warner and his legacy. Well, Joe Frazier has a legacy too. And we need to find a way to honor black men. I don't particularly care for the statue that Philadelphia finally erected, because although it might have been his greatest triumph in landing that left hook was, it snapped the chin of the late great Muhammad Ali. And it just, I know it's internal with me, but also know how messaging works, subliminal messaging. Taking a shot at, by raising Joe Frazier up, took a shot at Muhammad Ali's legacy. That was some sneaky shit. You know, like I wasn't going to catch on. But I understand how symbolism works. And then there's this. So this project that I'm talking about now is called the Jegna Chain. For those of you who don't know what the term Jegna is, Jegna is an Ethiopian term. All right. Now, Ethiopia at the time was referred to as Abyssinia by Europeans who had a disdain for the dark complexion of their skin. Nevertheless, it represented the title was one of high distinction in African cultural traditions. A Jegna is more than just a mentor or an elder. They are protectors of the people, land, and culture. Some of the core principles of the term Jegna, and I have to give credit to the Association of Black Psychologists who contributed to the research and the publication of a lot of this information. But a Jegna has been tested in the struggle of battle, demonstrated extraordinary fearlessness, shows consistent courage, determination in protecting the community and heritage, is dedicated to uplifting and nurturing others, especially the youth, produces high quality work while maintaining cultural integrity, and continues to grow and learn with an active sense of connection to future generations. A Jegna is not merely a wise elder, but a living example of leadership, honor, and evolution. One who transforms lifelong experiences into a legacy of guidance. So, that's just to tell you what a Jegna is. And I have several, and I've had more. Some have transitioned into our ancestors, right? And to some, I have become Jegna. And we have young Jegnas in chains. So let me tell you about the Jegna Chain, the concept. At the core of the Jegna Chain is a symbolic and literal chain of men, each pulling the next one forward. And it's not just men, right? Because we're going to go down beyond men, just men. We're going to get into the primary school ages, elementary school ages. We're going to reach back. Because as we said before, there has not been a consistent roadmap or blueprint from black boys to becoming black men in this country. It's been stripped around the world, and you can see it. Thank God we're starting to see some resistance in many of the countries in Africa, and we're starting to see resistance here in America, black America. This whole push beyond the FBA, Foundation of Black Americans, that's a masculine push. The notion behind Ice Cube and a plan for Black America, that's a masculine push. Hell, we were part of it, me and the team of brothers and sisters, when we did the Independence Day project, because that's a masculine push. The world doesn't happen to us. We make things happen in the world. Quote my good brother, Patrick Irwin. Right? So, and I would mention my Jegnas, but, you know, sometimes you need to offer them, you know, anonymity, because you don't want them to, you know, catch, you know, what do they call it, become collateral damage to when people aim their arrows at you. So this is the program. Elder Jegness will lead by example, guiding men and mentoring young Jegness. Okay, so we use the term mentor, but we're not mentors. Okay, it's just to make the language palatable for those who need to understand it. Excuse me. So the younger Jegness then mentor adolescents, building a self-replicating model of empowerment. Over time, the mentees become the mentors, and the cycle of growth continues, creating an unbroken chain of cultural stewardship, resilience, and leadership. So you may ask, and what are the program objectives? To build sustainable mentorship networks, or JEGNA-ship networks. Connect men across generational lines to serve as mentors, leaders, and cultural stewards. That's right, protectors of the culture. There's something to be said about that, because there's a black fraternity made of just black men called Sigma Pi Phi. And we all, many people don't know that, those call letters, those Greek call letters, but they're actually who we refer to as the official Black Boule. And the Black Boule's sole purpose is they are the keepers of the urn. And nobody has ever asked, what are they protecting in that urn? This is the elite. This is those who became the talented 10th, those who created the glass ceilings, the buffer communities between black prominence and black poverty in America. And you find them in various different places. But what we're talking about is building something here that sort of combats that, as well as other cultural, non-cultural influences that influence our culture. So what are some of the other objectives? To restore foundational principles. To reintroduce and reinforce traditional African values in modern context. Now, you may say, wow, you just said you were foundational Black American. Many of you don't understand, because you become so tribal and territorial. You don't understand what that means. FBA, Foundational Black American, this is ADOS, American Descendants of Slaves. One of the things that we are, where did those slaves come from? Many of you can claim that we had some natives that were here, but where did the natives come from? We all are branches and leaves that were rooted in the tree of Africa. We're all part of the African, the Pan-African network. And, you know, because some of you loonies out there, this sounds like tether talk. Listen, was Malcolm X a tether? I asked that question because the concept comes from him. As he broke it down in his Ballad of the Bullet speech, where you have black people, you need to have nationalism based on the land, ownership of the land. Black nationalism, but then if we have black nationalism here, you have black nationalism in Jamaica, the rest of the Caribbean, South American countries, Haiti. If you have nationalism. And you do have nationalism in all these other places, in each of the different regions in Africa, the different cultures, the different spiritual networks and communities. That network is the Pan-African network. It's the umbrella of Pan-Africanism that is fueled by nationalism of each group of Black people, including foundational Black Americans here in America. Class is in session, y'all. I'm in full teacher mode tonight, or today, whenever the hell you listen to this. And by the way, I know I'm late. Check us out on FetLife Station at FetLifeStation.com. Alright. Check us out. True crime, true stories. And we have another network. It remiss me because today, I'm recording this at night. So it's going to be aired on Philly Fridays, but it'll also be aired wherever you're streaming. This is the first freestyle show I've done in a few years. So forgive me for not following the particular script, but I want to get to this. So let's talk about restoring foundational principles, reintroducing, reinforcing traditional African values in modern context. Tell me if this doesn't sound okay to you. Integrity, respect, responsibility, honor, accountability, and dignity. Now let me ask you something. Did former President Obama say it like this? I'm just bringing that to your attention. This is what about. So when you speak with intentionality, he spoke with intentionality, and I'm currently speaking with intentionality. The message is getting driven home. Another objective: develop leadership and character. Encourage the development of emotional intelligence. And Black men do have a lot of emotional intelligence. It's just not used in ways we understand. And because it's not described in certain ways, we assume what we have is not emotional intelligence rather than raw instinct, but that comes from the emotional intelligence of your experiences and how to act and operate in certain situations. We do it all the time with the women in our community. Do I look good in this dress? Yes, mama. Knowing damn well she need to take that circus tent off. All right? So, community responsibility and self-discipline amongst young Black men. And this is something we're truly trying to drive home with all the temptations in the world, with all the different things that are presented to our Black men, all the distractions. We have to make it an obligation to consistently hone on the the act of discipline within our community. Okay. Establish legacy and continuity. We want to promote a legacy mindset where knowledge, wisdom, tradition, and traditions are passed down systemically and purposefully. And that also includes wealth building. All right. So what is our target population? Primarily Black men aged between the ages of 18 and 70. That's the target right now. But we will be focused on secondary in terms of high schools, high school age Black males to be integrated later on in the program phases. In other words, once we establish the head of the chain, each part of the chain goes a generation behind them. And we keep going back a generation until we get to the point where we're snatching these young brothers out the cradle. And before y'all say we need to do something for the girls, everything's been done for the girls. What we need to do what sisterhood needs to do is maintain the same type of concepts, but they're more geared to what the feminine nature truly is aspired to be. I won't speak on those things today, but the masculine and feminine energies together create balance. When one is missing or one is short, you create a toxic imbalance. I know what I see. So, more components. Like, what would the program components look like? So, monthly integrational circles. In other words, we would facilitate discussions centered on shared experiences, values, and life lessons. Skills, character development workshops. We would do trainings in leadership, communication, accountability, and community service. Being a part of the community is important. Our legacy projects. Participants document and share their learned experiences, lessons learned for the next generation. In other words, we pass this down. It's like an extension of the griot. You know, the griot is an elder who tells stories, gives the history, passes it down to the generations. They say once the elder dies, it's like the burning down of a great library because all the information goes with the elder. But we're going to make sure that just like the pyramids, our words are going to be longstanding. Our works are going to be longstanding. Rites of passage. Okay. Ceremonies and benchmarks that celebrate growth, learning, and readiness for new stages of life and leadership. In conclusion, the Jegna Chain is more than a mentorship program. It is a cultural revival rooted in African traditions and spiritual continuity. By linking generations of Black men in mutual growth and responsibility, this initiative seeks to reshape the narratives of manhood, leadership, service, and in our community for generations to come. This is the Jegna Chain. And one of the many things that we're focused on is this has been one of my babies. It's taken me some time to round it all up, but I finally got it. And I plan on implementing this, the prototype, the outlines, and workshops all over the world to unveil this in spaces where we can actually start to implement some of these things. Because amongst these things, we're actually going to talk about concepts like group economics, concepts like understanding politicals, being politically educated. And when I say politically educated, it's not just knowing about the politics, politicians in your area or in any of the major parties. What I mean by political education is that you actually learn, we actually learn who we are in the world, our place in the world, and how those things impact us individually and culturally as a community. And when you understand those things, you understand your impact, you understand your virility, you understand your purpose. So, think long and hard before falling under the leadership of those falling idols. You know, and you know, I taught ethical issues in professional life for 11 years. I actually rewrote the curriculum when I was teaching at Harcum College. One of the lessons I would teach would be the one peer pressure where it talked about social conformities and the different types of social conformities. One of them was falling in line with authority figures. So in the 1960s, there was a guy, his name was Milgram, Dr. Milgram. Don't give me that, say his first name. I don't feel like looking it up right now. Milgram had witnessed what happened during the Nuremberg trials, when the Nazi war criminals were all put on trial, and when they were asked why did they perform these acts of genocide, they all stated they were simply following orders. And he wondered how that tied into the power of people believing that they were under the leadership of some authority figure. Did the Milgram experiment where he had on one side of the board, he had one guy who is on the other side. He's supposed to answer these questions. He's tied up to this machine. This machine distributes electric shocks. And the more questions you get wrong, the higher the voltage goes until it reaches a lethal dose. On the other side of the screen, you have two people. You have a person who was a volunteer, unknowingly, you know, part of the experiment, as well as the person who's simply wearing a lab jacket. The person, the volunteer, is egged on by the so-called person in authority just because they're wearing the lab jacket. Gives the presence of an authority figure. And guess, you know, and it was an act, of course, but guess how many people actually pulled the lever to distribute the lethal dose of electric shock to the person on the other side of the board? A whopping 68%. That's almost 7 out of 10 people. And what they were basically saying, and they had this recorded, they said, if this guy dies, it's on you. Pointing to the man in the lab, he said, I'm totally willing to accept the responsibility. Push the button. And they would go along and push the button. Now, the actor's on the other side of the screen screaming and hollering every time the buzzer goes off. Until it points to get to a point where he's no longer responding to any of the buzzing. The people still did it. And that's why, that's the dangers of following those who are influencers and power, things of that nature. Because most people don't really have a mind of their own. They lack the ability to think independently and critically. So because of that, they often follow the leader or the perceived leader. Story of the Pied Piper. Pied Piper was paid to come to town and lead the rats out of the town. He did so, led the rats right off a cliff. They all died. They said, we're not... Pied Piper came back and said, hey, where's my money? He said, we're not going to pay you. He said, word? Okay. But the Pied Piper came back in the middle of the night. And this time, he took all the children from the village. And when the people say, okay, it was time, we got the money, we'll bring our children back, it's too late. He then revealed to them that he played the flute, the pipe, whatever, and marched their children right off a cliff. Many of you are right now listening to the lovable tunes of the Pied Pipers. You better wake up. And with that said, family, I want to thank you all for tuning in. Hope you this message was received well. I'm glad to be back. And whatever can I say? You know, stay safe, stay healthy, but more importantly, war and peace. Because if you want war, if you want peace, you better be willing to wage war for it. And I am out of here.